Hi there, I'm Jason Memel, and I'm here on Talknosis, and today we're going to try something new, meet a Gnostic. We've done lots of shows interviewing experts and academics about their books and their fields of study, and this is probably part of the tradition of Gnosticism where searching for a new kernel of wisdom might unlock some fresh door of experience. What we thought we'd also do is let you meet some of the people who call themselves Gnostics on top of what it is that we study and think about. So, if you're new to Gnosticism, maybe the absolute shortest way I can describe it is a kind of deeper knowing, something that you can't learn or be taught, but that you can discover, hence this search, through faith, mystical exploration, or my personal favorite, art. It can be described as remembering a deep connection, and then a deep connection that you didn't know you forgot. And a lot of older traditions, or what we often call classic Gnosticism, have whole cosmologies of figures that are either trying to keep us from remembering, or at the very least, get in the way of remembering, or in other cases, try to help us remember. So that's a really quick overview. The Gnostic we're going to meet is my co-host, the person who's been doing the show longer than me, the person whose voice you've probably heard if this isn't your first show, Jonathan Stewart.
Jason, real pleasure to be on. You know, long time listener, first time caller, big fan. You know, I've been watching, listening to this show for more than a decade now, and it's a real honor to finally be invited on. So thanks so much.
Well, I mean, we literally couldn't do this show without you.
You know, you could, because I inherited the show, right? Like a curse. So someday the curse will be passed on. It could be passed on to you. You never know. Us young bucks of the AJC.
You know, there's a lot to unpack there. And I think it's going to come up in some of my later questions. Part of me wants to dive into it right now, But honestly, before we dive into some of the what you and I are doing here on Talknosis and why we're doing it, because that's part of what makes us Gnostic and our expression of it, what's your like Gnostic origin story? Like, how did you come to this process, this system?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it allows me to talk about my favorite topic, which is myself.
Of course,
I think a lot of people in Gnosticism have a follow the breadcrumbs story, right? And that is sort of the way. Now, you know, we have to live our lives forward, but we can only understand our lives backwards, right? So I'm not necessarily, sometimes when you tell stories like this, it is a story, it is a narrative. It's the only way that we can understand ourselves, our personalities, and the universe. So, you know, was fate leaving out synchronicities for me to find? You know, maybe not. But from a young age, I've always had a mystical bent. You know, I always was looking into treetops for angels. You know, I had a grandfather that I really loved, who was a Mason, who loved ghost stories, who loved UFOs, who had the full collection of the talk about being young bucks, of the Time Life Mysteries of the World series, Jason. Do you know what that is? It's like these big black books. What we'll do is we'll link the commercials on YouTube. So they were big, but they were relatively thin, and they were like pop weird stuff books. So they were grouped by themes, right? So, you know, one was ghosts, one was you know strange sights, one was UFOs, cryptids, stuff like that. So he lived out in the country, and I'd, you know, just sit down and read those books. So all that said, as well as being, you know, quite strangely religious from a young age. Let's use what minute are we at here? People have already turned off the show. So strangely religious from a young age, because, you know, my immediate family, again, like this grandfather was religious. He was a deacon in his Presbyterian church. But my immediate family, you know, they were Christmas Christians. But from a young age, I felt a pull of faith, right? And a want and a need to discover. And to do more than hear stories, right? To live the stories, to have the experiences that one reads about in the Bible and so forth. And from a relatively young age, I found the Christian mystics and the Gnostics, you know. And sometimes I hate to admit this, but I think I'm in a safe space. I think, like many people, the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, right? You know, reading his books, people are going to find this hard to believe, but I was a bit of a nerdy kid. But So reading his books, finding tarot, I remember being quite fascinated by tarot at a young age, you know, buying decks. You know, I was always buying like weird new age books. You know, this was the 90s on Prince Edward Island, right? I fortunately did have a university library card that a friend let me use. So I was able to order in weird books, right? So I was into all this weird stuff. But I remember even in the 90s, in 1999, I was 17. So people, you can do the math about how old I am now. 17, is that right? And I don't know if I've ever told you the story, Jason, but two things happened, which was you know, I was either going to go to university or I was going to join a monastery. And I came quite close to going to a monastery in Nebraska for a year, and I mean very, very close. But I also remember something that happened around that time was finding gnosis.org, which was Bishop Heller's church, which is the Ecclesia Gnostica, which is a separate denomination from ours, but has a lot of the same lineages, comes from what they call the French Gnostic lineage. And finding out that there was a living Gnosticism in the modern age was very exciting. But, you know, I noticed that he only had a few churches. You had to be in person to study for his priesthood. So I'm like, okay, I'm probably not going to live in LA. So I'm probably never going to be part of this, but that's cool. The cool stuff. And then I did religious studies, thinking that I'd either go into possibly clergy of the United Church, as the denomination I came from, a wonderful church I'm still quite fond of, or maybe go into academia. But, you know, those career paths for a number of reasons. I'm sure people have already figured out that religious studies academia is not an easy career path. I'm sure a lot of the scholars we have here on the show can tell you all about that. And, you know, I was a writer from a young age as well. You know, for people who don't know, Jason and I were born on the same day in the same geographic area, are both science fiction, fantasy fans who became Gnostics and are theater people. And through theater,
it's pretty weird.
It is. Through theater, you know, I got into writing, right? Because I would just write my own plays. And I got into copywriting. You know, I moved to Montreal for a combination of school and chasing a girl. I didn't think I would stay here. I always thought, you know, I'll live here for a year or two. I've always liked Montreal. I'm still here. What year is it? That was 2006. Wow. So yeah, no, it's been a long time. A little off and on though, because, you know, I did live briefly in New York, and I kind of went back. We kind of used Montreal as a home base to live between a few different places. This is I think the show is almost over. So you know, when I turned 30, I started, you know, I've been going to the United Church here, but then I moved to a different neighborhood. I was also partying and, you know, getting up early for church on you know, it's Sunday, folks, that's after Saturday. So, you know, Montreal used to be the place where young people would go to retire. It has gentrified quite rapidly, but, you know, it used to be a pretty, it's still a fun loving place, but it used to be a very easygoing, fun loving place. I also moved neighborhoods, you know, so it wasn't just a licentious lifestyle where I wasn't even, you know, there was no United Church close to me in my new neighborhood. But when I turned 30, I'd been a bit of a spiritual seeker. I got it into meditation. You know, I had studied a few different groups. I'd gone to a few different services. I checked out a few, you know, Eastern religions, what have you. But I always felt the pull of Christ. And couldn't get the Jesus guy out of my system, which is, you know, something we talk about a lot. I had not stopped being a person of faith, but I had drifted away from my faith community and kind of being more active about it. When I turned 30, I started, you know, things happen. So I started to look for something deeper, you know, for a group or a more organized spirituality. And I actually found Martinism, which makes sense because I'm in a French city. And it actually was a French group that was starting its first ever English group. And for those that don't know, I mean, we can't explain entirely what Martinism is in just, you know, we have a playlist.
Yeah, so we've done episodes. Yeah.
We've done episodes. We have a whole Martinist playlist. You know, this is debate-ish, but The at least in my reading, you know, there's a lot of Gnostic streams of thought in Martinism. It's not a public church. Some people will call it secret. You know, I'd say that it's private. You know, if you want to know the secrets, they're all online, so it's not particularly secret. Not only online, but in your local bookstores. We've talked about lots of Martinist books on the show.
Of course.
Yeah, and Martinism, being this French kind of Gnostic-y esoteric movement from the 1700s and 1800s, it had a close relationship with the French Gnostic Church, because there's a revival of Gnosticism in the 1800s in a more structured ecclesiastical church-like fashion. And it was through Martinism that I discovered the Apostolic Johannine Church. Just while Googling about Martinism, there was a priest giving a talk about Martinism, and, you know, oh, okay, he's a priest, oh, and he's in this AJC thing, and oh, you know, the head bishop, the patriarch, is actually in Canada. And so I started corresponding with these weirdos. And, you know, I actually dipped my toe in the water, you know, relatively cautiously, to be honest, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, it started off with some emails, and then I went to the first conclave, my first conclave, not the first conclave, which is, you know, a mix of sort of conference and spiritual retreat in 2013. You know, I have a religious studies background. I know what a dangerous cult is. Of course, that's what everybody says who, you know, ends up joining a dangerous cult, right? Very intelligent people, by the way, all jokes aside. It's usually middle-class educated, college-educated people who are like the backbones of cults, and very, very educated people join cults. But, you know, I knew what a dangerous cult was. And I also knew what a foolish cult was. So, because there's some out there that aren't dangerous, but are a waste of your time. And the AJC didn't strike me as any of those things. So you know, I continue to get more and more involved, and here I am, the end. But you know, if you also talk about like faith journey, you know, I had always had this Christian mystic bent, but, you know, from an early age, Gnosticism had resonated with me, and even when I wasn't formally practicing or studying it, it was still an obsession of mine, right? You know, throughout my 20s, even when I wasn't involved of any groups, right? So I was always reading about it. I always identified as it. Maybe I wouldn't talk to people. I wouldn't say that I'm a Gnostic to somebody, because then they're like, oh, you're agnostic, me too. Or, you know, actually I'm an atheist. And then you have to have the whole conversation, you know, to having this show or doing more public Gnostic things in Montreal is a better place to have that conversation. So, totally. Yeah, so I think that's me in a nutshell.
you are doing the nutshell dance. But no, that's great. And I think that's like part of the reason I wanted to do this series and why I wanted to ask these questions is because I think like everybody has their own story, but their own story has commonalities with a lot of other stories.
Yeah.
You know, like moments of like recognition of something, something that you're maybe following out of an internal desire, that kind of thing. Like that's a lot of what I was hearing there. But also like opportunity, like the things that like the things being in the right place, you know, such as the AJC, because that's my own experience with them, is that they were in the right place at the right time and were like a level-headed, you know, good group of people that I could go like, okay, I can explore with these people. So
yeah. You know, this every time we talk about the AJC, it sounds like we're doing a commercial for them, but it is honestly what we believe, and it's been our experience. And I think what some people have trouble who online or who have not experienced the AJC is that there's a lot of flexibility, but not so much that there's nothing going on, right? They create a container for you to study, experience, and practice Gnosticism, right? And I think that container is important, and so is community. I've always been a joiner, Jason. You know, my parents signed me up for a lot of things as a kid. You know, I have little brother, even though I don't have an older brother, like little brother, like lonely kid syndrome, even though like this is not a brag. I actually always had friends, but you know, it's whatever reason, right? I haven't figured it out in my psychoanalysis yet. some of the little the little brother stuff is just being a September kid and being right on the cutoff for going into the grade and being you know kind of verbose and quote unquote a little bit more intelligent. I wasn't, right? That's why people at home see me doing quote unquote. The verbose part, however, is true, right? People have already figured that out. So, you know, I hung out with a lot of people older than me. And, you know, when I started doing theater, I did theater, a lot of theater with a lot of older people. You know, when you do community theater and semi-professional theater, well, you know, like I'm cast in a role that's appropriate to my age, but there's a whole range of ages, right? So, you know, you can go to the cast parties, be like, oh, wow, I can have a beer. This is so cool. I'm so sophisticated and talk about art and what have you. Mm-hmm. I've always been a joiner, and I understand that people are out there aren't joiners, but you know, I used to be, that's good, you know, you have your own path, you do you, but as the world burns, as our institutions fall apart, I think people need to become joiners, and you don't have to join the AJC, but you, if you feel the pull of Gnosis, and if you're watching the show, then you are, then join something for the love of God, right? Just have a reading group and go make sandwiches for the homeless or something, because we need to find new ways to live in community and to rebuild community. That was a bit of a rant, but it does great. Go off of my, it is actually a development in me, because you know, when I talk about the AJC in the past, people, there's 200 shows, you can go back and watch it. I'm always careful to say, and I'm still careful to say, like, this may not be the path for you. Maybe you're not a joiner, but I have pivoted to, this may not be the path for you, but you should join something that is safe and will give you a container. Communities also keep you more honest, and you have at least some kind of tradition, right? You have like some guardrails, even if they're a little bit sketchy.
Yeah.
If they're because you know, when you try to do it yourself, it just becomes a personal religion, or it just becomes nothing, right? And sometimes it is hard to figure out what is acceptable, what's not acceptable, what it is that the AJC is doing dogmatically, because it's not a dogmatic church, right? So by the way, fans of the show, this will be somebody's first show. It could be about 3,000 people listening to the show. It could be lots of people's first show. We talk about the Apostolic Johannine Church, even though I wear the collar as a deacon, I'm not speaking on behalf of the denomination, on behalf of Talk Gnosis, on behalf of even my local group, right? It's it's just me riffing. So
yeah.
Jason, do you have more questions?
I do have more questions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I like some of what you were saying there that you've pivoted to, regarding like that, you know. You know, maybe joining isn't for everybody, but you should join something.
Yeah.
Is that like what's capturing your interest most in Gnosticism right now? Like, I think in a lot of ways, episodes on this show show a lot of us what's capturing your interest right now, because, you know, you go and find those people and you talk to them. But like, how would you define that in terms of your sort of current Gnostic practice, your current Gnostic life? You know, is it about this idea of thinking a bit more about community, or is it about like, I know you've got a thesis you're working on, like, talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, no, I think so, right? Because it's what you do with it, and it being Gnosticism, and there is just I am a Christian Gnostic at the end of the day, or maybe a Gnostic Christian. We'll figure out which one of those two I am. So there is a call for community there. And I think that's where you can both find Gnosis, where you can put Gnosticism into action, right? You know, what's great with my local group, which is quite small, of course, like many Gnostic groups, the local parish, but we have a great member, the actual only formal other member of the AJC in Montreal, because she joined during Conclave, which is Christina. And you know, well, I do my little ramble after mass, or after meditation, which is usually on a specific topic, or you know, whatever the holiday is, or feast day that's being celebrated. And you know, Christina always has radically different interpretations of mine, right? And isn't afraid to speak up, which is great, and be like, no, I don't think that's it at all. But, you know, she's also very respectful. And, you know, just when it comes to understanding this stuff and embracing this stuff, you know, that's important and that's fun, right? As well as some of those deeper things about, you know, what is life for? What are we here for? How can we help others? You know, there's all these subtleties. Whenever I say Gnosticism, I usually just mean the Apophicon of John, Secret John, right? Which is what I kind of use as the paradigm, but it's often been used as the paradigm of the Gnostic myth. So, but it's full of all these subtleties and things I'll never understand. It's actually full of Stoicism, Jason, because I've been doing some reason, but it's totally research. But a lot of it is like the theological side of Stoicism and the cosmology, because they did, you know, it's not all about feelings and. You know, they were ancient Greeks who had a cosmology about, you know, fire and the gods and what have you.
Totally.
So
yeah.
That stuff's really apparently in the Apophicon of John. Although the stuff about the passions is in there too, actually. So so if you watch our show, Shirley Paulson, folks, because she talks about the passions in that, and a lot of that comes from Stoicism. Where was I? Oh yeah, the Apophicon of John. There's this very obvious. Like there's all these subtleties and things you'll never understand, and there's literally 5,000 books you have to read, because it's maybe the world's first hypertext. It's intertextual. It plays with all this Greek philosophy and Egyptian books and all that BS. And you know, I'll never understand that. I'll go to my grave. But it's also full of like really obvious stuff. So, and one of the really obvious metaphors is the fall of Sophia, you know, Sophia's error, what she did wrong, right? Which again, there's a number of symbolic aspects to it. But one of the things is you can look at it as she creates without her partner. Some people see a really sexist metaphor in there, but it's much more complicated than that. But here's the easy part. She goes away and she creates by herself. What it is when you're reading the Secret John, the Apophicon of John, I have talked about this in the show before. Everything happens as in a divine community, like united. So there's this outpouring of the divine as the divine splits into, you can pick a cell division or the Big Bang emanates. And each emanation happens with the community's permission, with the love of the community. And then Sophia breaks from the community, this divine community, and go does something all by herself and makes a big mistake. Then the next part, this is what something that I, you know, this is that part's very obvious. I think what a lot of people miss, that I think is intended by the author, the next part is she takes her mistake and she hides it in a cloud and she pushes it away. So then that's the second part of the mistake. It's not only that she went off by herself and did this, that she made this mistake and then didn't bring it into the community. Right? That it could be healed and made part of the community. The community here is the Aeons. So I think that this is a teaching, that this is an obvious metaphor for the importance of community, right? And if you make mistakes, you should bring them back into the community, that you shouldn't, you know, be going off by yourself in this way. And if you do go fuck up off by yourself, then you can bleep that F-bomb, right? Then you can, there's always a chance to reconcile. So yeah, again, very very profound stuff in that book, and as for whatever reason, for the last year on the show, I've been saying a Hallmark card, you know, like a Chinese fortune cookie, just you know, but this stuff, the Hallmark card stuff is deeply profound. You know, sometimes the mysteries of life aren't that mysterious. So yeah, there's 12 minutes for a relatively simple question, but
no, I mean, this is what's on your mind right now. Yeah. And I think it's really important to hear. Like, I think, and there's lots of stuff to go off on there too. Like, just again, that the importance of reading it as a metaphor, I think, is sometimes we get like, and invariably like online, people will be really questioning. It's like, well, hey, how many layers are we talking about here? Or like, you know, is this entity more powerful than this entity, kind of thing? And it's like, sometimes I think it's important, as you say, remember that this is a story a hypertextual story that's trying to relate to other stories, you know?
Yeah. Metaphor, allegory, you know, I obviously use those interchangeably. I shouldn't. And here's the thing, Jason, it's great that you said that, because I think I've become very annoying about this. And I know I have, because maybe I've been kicked off some Discord servers and then allowed back in, because I don't want to, like, all this stuff, like the Gnosticism in my reading, particularly these texts, I keep saying Gnosticism, but I mean the texts, mm-hmm. are deliberately mysterious. You know, the Gospel of Thomas is deliberately mysterious. This is meant, I think, for a few different reasons. One reason is you're probably supposed to work through it with a teacher or with the community or with the teacher and a community, and there's oral teachings that we've lost. But, mm-hmm. but two, they're mysterious and infuriating because it's to expand your consciousness. It's the Zen koan thing, right?
Exactly.
To get you out of linear day-to-day secular materialistic worldly thinking. So when approaching these texts, it's very important for me in general, not just with these texts, but with anything related to Gnosticism, that, you know, I'm not the king of Gnosticism. My interpretation of Gnosticism is not the only right one. I can learn from others. I'm very humble, honestly, folks. When it comes to my relationship with Gnosticism, in my reading of Gnosticism, Gnosticism often takes some of the themes from Christianity and pushes them up to 11, right? Turns the volume up to 11 on them. And I think actually Christian humility is one of them. Part of that humility is Gnosticism, something else I've been saying a lot lately, you know, we often hear about the gnosis and knowing, but I think it's also a call for a radical on-knowing. That you have to on know what you think you know so that you can know. So I think, like, lately I've really been banging the drum that folks, that these are, I'm mixing it up now, or these are metaphors, these are allegories, they're actually both, right? These are symbols. Yeah. But they're not just that. So I always want to include that part because I do think that because the other annoying people online, almost an annoying person online, is maybe somebody who's, I don't want to say a Jungian, but they're probably a Jungian. That, you know, that they're like, it's just symbolic of processes going on in the mind, right? Mm-hmm. And if you have been listening to me lately, or, you know, reading me on certain Discord servers, you'd think that is my approach, but it's not, right? I am banging the metaphor and allegory drum, but at the same time, I think we really impoverish the Gnostic mythos when we say it's just that. And people who listen and watch the show, they also know that I love saying people who listen and watch the show. They also know I love saying that it's not either or, it's and, right? It's
yeah,
plus.
Yeah.
So these things do work on a few different levels. And you know, if you read something like the Apophicon of John, it's just these levels that mirror each other, right? That's another teaching. Mm-hmm. The way the book is structured is a constant mirroring, you know, that starts with the divine creation, and then, you know, the middle creation, and then the demiurge's creation, which is a kind of weird parody of the divine creation. And we have these levels where these things are happening. So it is happening in your brain, man, but you don't know how big your mind is, man.
Yeah.
I messed up the quote. Jason. Also, get some video software and take like 10 pounds off me. give me like a real sharp chin. But it's all in your head, man. You don't know how big your head is.
Yeah, there you go. You got the whole thing. That's Lon Milo Duquette, I think, that's his famous quote. And like when he says it, he's usually talking about ritual magic, like Aleister Crowley kind of style magic. And again, it's one of those things that when I hear people oppose him on that, I feel like they haven't really engaged with the depth of what he means by that, you know. Because I completely agree. Like, I think we're talking about so much of this stuff it's a Zen koan. It's meant to crack your head open. So taking it literally is the worst step, but also minimizing it is the worst step, you know? Yeah. Like, it's like you've got to not take it literally, but let yourself be open to something bigger than what it is.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like, I'm paraphrasing in terms of the stuff you're talking about, but like, I think that's a great way to kind of put it. And I'm going to jump around to my questions, the questions I sent you, and maybe come back to some of the other ones, but this might be then a good place to jump into something. And it's a subject you and I have discussed before in chat rooms and stuff, but, like in terms of your engagement of belief and your engagement in Christian belief, like I'm famously not churchy Gnostic. Like when we do my version of this episode and you're asking me the questions, I'll get more into what kind of a Gnostic I am. But like, I guess I'd like to hear a bit from you in terms of how you engage specifically like with a primary importance in Christianity, like really centering it. And I think I've got some more thoughts I want to go off there, but I think maybe I'll ask that question first and let you go with it, and then I'll build on it.
Yeah, I don't think you have to be a Christian to be a Gnostic. I do believe, and it's not as popular in scholarly circles anymore, but I do believe that the Gnosticism was pre-Christian. I think that there are valid non-Christian forms of it, and I think you could find your form and probably find groups as well. And there's a place like the AJC where, you know, you don't have to be a Christian to be a member. You just have to be comfortable with Christian symbolism. Mm-hmm. But you know, unlike my earlier call for people should just join at something, right? Something safe and good. That doesn't, of course, have to be a Christian church. And that's where it is, you know, my way, your way, whatever way. For me, it's whatever cultural imprinting. I'm secularizing it, right? Like, mm-hmm. because I do believe in Gnostic Jesus, right? So, mm-hmm. But I believe the Gnostic Jesus is the Logos and appears and manifests as all sorts of things. So, and people and entities and deities, probably.
That's interesting.
Yeah, the Logos, Gnostic Jesus, has called me to know the Logos, the wisdom, the wisdom of God, which would be Sophia, but it's also kind of the Logos, has called me to know him through the person of Jesus Christ. That seems to work with whatever presets my brain has, as well as the culture I grew up in, right? Mm-hmm. So, as I said, I've tried the other stuff, right? You know, I tried Buddhism, and I just, Jesus won't leave me alone, and there's times that I wish that he would. So, but you know, you don't have to have that to be a Gnostic. You don't have to have that to be a Christian, actually, if you ask me. So don't worry about that if you don't have that kind of egg in you.
This is one of the other things I was going to get onto there was, when we were talking earlier about like, some people who've kind of been, you know, like had trepidation towards the AJC or like, sort of starting from a position of disagreeing with it. Like, I often wonder if there's a lot of early Gnostic, academia was really focused on its rebelliousness from Orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And so like, if anything that looks like a Christian church looks like joining the thing that they got excited about rebelling from, if that makes sense in terms of what I'm trying to kind of say. So then it like, it kind of starts an argument no one really wanted to have, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know? For sure. And I think a lot of Christian Gnostics spend a lot of time saying, you know, we're not like those Christians, you know what I mean? But, you know, mm-hmm. honestly, a lot of people have grown up secular now, and they have a very mm-hmm. cartoon idea of what Christianity is. And sort of, you know, left-wing, progressive, gay-embracing, socially, did I already say progressive, mm-hmm. Christianity has been mainstream since the 60s, and in some areas and forms dominant. Actually, in the 60s was more or less dominant if you're going to talk about the Protestant mainline, right? Mm-hmm. The evangelicals and fundamentalists were around, but fundamentalists in particular, that people don't realize this because they make so much noise, and didn't really enter the political sphere until the 70s, where they were kind of brought in. You know, they thought that the world was a fallen dark place, and politics likewise, so they thought that they should not sully themselves with it. That's fundamentalists. Not all evangelicals are fundamentalists. Not all fundamentalists are evangelicals. Not all evangelicals are conservative, by the way. So, so actually, in the 60s, Mr. Rogers was a Christian minister, Jason, and that was we're talking about Protestantism here. That was basically mainstream, mainline Protestantism in the 60s. Martin Luther King, of course, was a minister. And the sort of extremely progressive Christianity is still dominant in lots of areas and circles. But, you know, a funny thing happened. You know, people were given the kind of faith they were asking for, and they all left the church.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think that's very interesting. But sorry, that's going into rants. Now, obviously, there's all sorts of dominant mainstream negative Christianities that continue to do evil things, right? Mm-hmm. And people do come from those backgrounds. And, you know, I would actually argue, because of this rebelliousness that you mentioned, you know, Gnosticism, Christian Gnosticism is a great place for you to end up if you have that background. But I meet a lot of people who don't have that background, and they still have this cartoon of what Christianity is. So you have to spend a lot of time saying that, you know, we're not like those Christians. And it's a little bit silly. I wish that there was better education and better experiences out there, but we live in a secular society, right? So
yeah,
I think what a lot of people with the recent and of course it's not a political show, we can't talk about politics per se, but you know, we can observe the news, particularly in the United States, you see a lot of changes happening, you know, coming from agitation from the Christian right. But what a lot of people don't realize is that like there's still, you know, huge conservative evangelical fundamentalist churches, right? You know, those you can see them in your mind, but you know, a lot of those churches are dying, even in small towns. Like those churches are empty, and where the people who are going to those churches are going is like online to like QAnon groups. So, right. So we really are, like, you know, secularization, I guess that's not secularization, that's the transferring of our religious impulses is very heavily upon us. And it's just like, it is kind of funny that this is now that the Christian right is making its gains, when, you know, they're in some ways their power is waning number wise. Now obviously there's tons and tons of counterexamples to what I'm talking about, right? You can walk to lots of giant mega churches, but as an overall trend, this is what's happening. So again, even that cartoon of Christianity is not necessarily accurate.
Mm-hmm. I think something that you've even touched on there, the notion of the mega churches sort of getting hollowed out, and but that impulse not going away and shifting somewhere else. There's sort of a whole there's been a discussion in various places lately about this idea of re-enchantment of the world, and I feel like that's somehow connected there. Maybe that's a whole other show we figure out to do.
We really should do. I mean, we could probably do a little mini series on re-enchantment, honestly, because there's a lot of great thinkers and people out there also thinking about it and writing about it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even if I was an atheist, even if you're an atheist, or whoever is watching this, you know, I would think that I can still make the argument, maybe even more powerfully so, from an atheistic standpoint, that humans are religious animals, that we have these impulses. If you want to phrase it this way, right? We have these impulses that for the last couple hundred years, because in the West, you know, the religion is really something kind of created out of the Enlightenment, right? They didn't have these sharp lines between, like, you know, art, literature, politics, society, religion, right? These all blended together. And it's more of a modernist way of thinking that we segregate out a bunch of beliefs and behaviors that people have and say this is religion. But it seems that some of these beliefs, that these behaviors do seem to be hardwired into us, and we have to do something with them. And religion can be, I mean, obviously it can become negative and cultish and destructive, but at least it's being honest about what it's doing with these impulses at the end of the day. I think now, and I've talked about this on the show, a lot of our religious impulses are being transferred to all sorts of weird places, right? And I think there's ways to channel them that are not necessarily into religion if you're not a religion person. I think humans have a need for transcendence, or at least to seek transcendence. You know, that art is a great output for that.
I was just going to say. Yeah. So, yeah, like, I mean, again, we should, well, we've done shows on art, and we should do more shows on art. And I'll probably talk about this when we get into my episode of this, but yeah, no, getting back, I think more just to focus on you though, is like, what are some of your own like practices? How are you like being a Gnostic, you know? Cause I think, I think, the reason I wanted to ask this question, the reason I want to do this series of shows is that I think when I started wanting to find out about Gnosticism, I found a lot of people talking about what Gnosticism was. Like, you know, here's the theories about it. Here's the structures. Here's, you know, the what we know from history and like a lot of the theory. But there wasn't a whole lot of like, how do you go be Gnostic? You know, the joke I often say to our local guy in here, Calgary, Sean, who we've had on the show before, is like, what do I do when somebody cuts me off in traffic? Like, how does Gnosticism help me there? You know, which isn't to say that spiritual impulses have to be only practical at the most base level, but it is more about like, how do I be a Gnostic when I'm not on Discord or on Reddit or reading a book or listening to a podcast? You know, how do you like live that? So that's a really rambling way to get around my question, but yeah, how do you kind of live that?
Yeah, well, hypothetically, I'd say I have a daily spiritual practice, but we're in a chat together where we log our spiritual practice, so you know that that's not true. But that's, folks, I have a baby, so I'm going to get back to it. So I would say a daily formal spiritual practice, you know, the church twice a month, right, mm-hmm. is when we meet, Martinism once a month, you know, it is funny because there is all this grand mythos and theories and all this fun stuff with Gnosticism. But, you know, I sort of have an out with Christian Gnosticism, which is, which is, you know, some of those trying to practice those traditional Christian virtues of mm-hmm. honesty, humility. Folks, I keep coming back to humility, right? Because if you're watching this at home, you can see literally the size of my head, right? It is that I have a large head, so it makes sense that it works metaphorically as well. So that's an illustration of what Jason and I were talking about. Hopefully you're listening to this as a podcast. What else? I think for Gnosticism as well, where you know, you can have this in traditional Christianity where all human beings are equal because they have the breath of God, right? You know, Gnosticism takes it up to 11, where we're all lost gods. And I think, you know, just understanding other people as lost gods and actually trying to interact with them in that way, viewing them in that way, that leads to a real change of heart, right? Just in mm-hmm. your daily practice with people and compassion for people. I think too, for specifically Gnosticism, you know, it's funny because, you know, I've been doing a run of shows or had a lot of guests on that were talking about, you know, how a lot of these texts are misread and they're not as negative as you would think. And there's some agreements I have there, because I think that the texts are paradoxical, or maybe a better word would be dialectical, where there is this paradox of divinity poured out into the world. A lot of hope there, and a lot of beauty there. But at the same time, you know, that existentialist, depressing reading of Gnosticism that a lot of scholars say now is not necessarily correct, or of these texts, Gnostic texts, mm-hmm. or of these texts formerly called Gnostic. You know, I'm actually a big fan of those more depressing readings. And I think understanding that, you know, maybe a Christian may say we live in a fallen world, right? But, you know, taking it one step further as a Gnostic, and, you know, not just a fallen world, but a world where everything is always going to be a little bit broken, right? Mm-hmm. A world that is ruled by something that doesn't have your best interests at heart. You know, that there is a certain tragic dimension to life. at all times. You know, putting that into practice, I think, is actually a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Because it allows you to appreciate the good things more. It allows you to have more sympathy and compassion for those around you. And it helps you to understand that you're not the center of the universe, and that, you know, things go wrong because they're supposed to go wrong because that's the nature of this world, right? It's not always a very nice place. And I think kind of touching that reality is very sobering and depressing, but at the same time, it's more honest, and perhaps a better way to live one's life, because it allows you to see things as they really are, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I would sum up Gnosticism, you know, the purpose of life in Gnosticism is to become disillusioned without becoming, you know, cynical and hard-hearted. So, you know, there is a certain amount of, literally disillusionment that Gnosticism calls for, right? Because you're supposed mm-hmm. to see through the illusions of the rulers and principalities of this age and of this world. So, it's hard to do that and not become, staring into the abyss, the abyss stares back. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, at the same time, because we have all this happy stuff in Gnosticism, there's a good countervailing weight there. So yeah, so I think all those rambles kind of address living it.
Well, and I think, like, something that you've pointed out here, and I've heard you point it out before. This is kind of the meat of the stuff that I wanted to get into. Is that? But I think it's well encapsulated here. Is that? And it goes back even to the notion of not relativizing Gnosticism by just saying it's all in your head. That we also don't want to relativize or sanitize Gnosticism by saying it's like it's not that bad. You know, that there's no, you know, like, oh, the demiurge is just mistaken, we should forgive him, kind of thing. Like, although that can also be a valid reading, you know, if that's your approach. But where I'm going with this is that I think you've hit on something that I don't engage with very often, which is staring at the fact that bad things happen and not turning away from it or trying to ignore it. I think that's really important. I think that the thing that always comes up for me around this stuff is that I feel like it can turn into what I've often called the Gnostic trap, where all you talk about, or not you specifically, but all a person can end up talking about is the demiurge and the archons and Yaldabaoth and like how they're all out to get you and how it's all going to be bad. And if you just subscribe to our premium member feed, then we'll solve all your problems. How do you avoid kind of getting into the place in which that unflinching stare at what's going on in the world doesn't turn into the escape valve for those things? Like that, like I now just get to blame everything bad on these spiritual forces and that's it. Like, I don't have to engage with it anymore. How do you avoid that trap?
Yeah. And I think there's a danger there as well. And it's a danger of, you know, perhaps severe mental illness. If you think that these specific named spiritual forces are out to get you as an individual. Again, I think these things are more than metaphor. But at the same time, if they are real, they don't care that much about you as an individual. Maybe they care about the divine spark inside of you, which isn't even really you, if you're going with the Apophicon of John. It's they've set up a system, right? A destructive system, a machine, right? And mm-hmm. they've hit go on the machine, and we're stuck in this machine being ground up within it. And it's a real downer, man. But I think too that understanding some of the impersonal nature of it, not taking it personally. I think too, you know, I differ from, you know, this is a little bit tricky, right? Because it's mm-hmm. what do you do with a religion that's been dead until the 1800s, and even then is pretty tiny. You know, the AJC is non-dogmatic. As I said, we're probably missing certain keys and understandings for these texts. There's I I think it is in the text. I think it is there in Secret John, right? Where there is an awful lot about getting out of this world and liberation from this world. But I don't know how literally we should take that, because at the same time, you know, this great outpouring of God is a material thing, right? The Gnosticism is radically incarnational. It's more incarnational than mainstream Christianity, because it's not just Christ that's the incarnated God. It's all of us as the incarnated God, right? So so where is God as far as we can know and understand him? He's here in materiality. And as I've talked about before, there seems to be some use, meaning to this materiality for God trying to understand itself. Again, you know, Sophia just means wisdom, the wisdom of God. The wisdom of God tries to know God, and when the wisdom of God tries to know God, what happens is the material world. You know, that seems, you know, I gotta say that seems that indicates that there's some sort of purpose to the material world. I'm atheistic enough to, you know, lots of ancient peoples didn't believe in life after death. And if there is life after death, there's kind of different forms of Gnosticism and Gnostic-y religions, where we're fully formed intelligences, right? We're angels before the fall, right? That's Cathartism. But if you look at the Apocryphon of John, and this is also Platonism, where we're identities, we're souls before we fall into matter. It's Hermeticism as well. But that's not in the Apocryphon of John, right? The Demiurge doesn't hijack a bunch of people, doesn't hijack a bunch of aeons, doesn't steal a bunch of souls. It steals the dynamis from Sophia. Dynamis is a very interesting word, Jason, because it's usually translated as power, but it can also, and it does mean power, but it can also be translated as something like potential. Anyway, steals this power, this potential from Sophia, and that's what becomes us, right? And at the same time, but that thing's embedded in us, you know, that's something like deep inside of us, but what we think is us is covers that, right? Covers up that shard. So even when I die, you know, that shard will continue, but it's not me as I know myself. So, you know, we're talking how many angels can dance on the head of a pin here, about life after death. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I do believe in life after death, and I'm not an Apocryphon of John fundamentalist either, right? Some days I wake up and have very traditional Christian ideas about life after death, but I think it's healthy to live sometimes as if there is no life after death. And as I said, if you're going by Gnostic rules, you know, if you want to get out of here, well, you're the dynamis, so you are not getting out of here. So I think that if you're going to go by the mythos, understanding that the materiality in this world is important and has its place, and you have a place in it, even if it's lousy, then that's something.
You know? Totally. Yeah. No, that's great.
I'd rather be some conscious stardust. You know, I'm glad that this I'm glad after the Great Bang that this stardust coalesced here, even if it's awful. So I think that more or less answers the question.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, like, I would say to kind of even temper some of what you're saying to make sure that maybe people are hearing all of it. Although maybe I'm not understanding you correctly, and this will be where you'll correct me, but like, you're not also necessarily saying that reality as we know it is uniformly terrible, like everything about it is terrible. It might be diminished or fallen or you know, broken, or in, you know, whatever the term one might use might be, but there are moments within it that have reward, you know, have value at a spiritual level, not just at a physical level.
Exactly. And again, you're getting into like Hallmark shit. Oh, can you edit that? Okay. I got. I don't know what's up with me tonight. See what happens when I'm not the host, Jason. I just I tell a potty mouth. Yeah, it just sounds like Hallmark stuff, but it's true, right? And it's I think it's a worthy way and maybe a healthy way to live one's life. Now, I'm not preaching because I don't always live my life like that, right? So it's something that I aspire to, and it's also, you know, there's a crack in everything, but that's how the light gets in. Because again, it kind of sounds like Hallmark stuff, and it, I think not. Narcissism takes suffering seriously, and the divine actually doesn't want us to suffer, and there's not a plan where we're supposed to be tortured. But at the same time, this materiality that is important, that is inevitable. You know, I think in the Apophicon of John it says that it's inevitable. The Big Bang was inevitable. So I think that it does take suffering seriously and says it's bad. And you know, it's not that suffering is a test or we have to suffer so we know what non-suffering is, but more mysteriously and harder to understand is there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in, right? Because again, I like saying dialectically a lot because it makes you sound smart, I think. You know, dialectically, this is what allows us to not only appreciate but to have good things, right? So you know, we can't have any good things in this world without bad things to accompany them, because that is the nature of materiality.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, like that almost sounds like. When I say this, I don't mean it in accordance to their spiritual tradition, more like what is commonly known of in terms of their binary equality, but Manichaeanism. In terms of that, like it's almost a logical process. If we have good things, then we are also going to have bad things, you know, that they are like literally connected by virtue of being one or the other, versus a completely undiluted single thing. That's interesting. This has been great. And I'm going to do two things. First, the first thing I'm going to do is, before I forget, I'm going to do a quick Patreon pitch. if any of you listening are enjoying the show, please feel free to, what is it again? PayPal or no,
patreon.com/Gnostic.
For funding at all different kinds of levels, or individual amounts that you want to give. We can do more of what we're doing here. We take requests. We'll do cover bands if you want us to play a song. Well, maybe not. I'm not a very good singer, but yeah, if you want to contribute to the conversation that we're having and be a part of that, be a part of the community, as you were talking about earlier, then this would be a great place to start. That'll be my Patreon pitch. My last question, and if this is a question actually you're not comfortable answering, then that's fine. And we can just kind of, we'll find a natural close after that. But, you've become a father recently, you know, you have a family now. How is that experience for you? As a Gnostic, like, are you experiencing anything? Are you encountering anything in terms of your belief, in terms of the things you're seeing in the world, you know, as part of this thing that's happened to you?
Yeah, for sure. I think too, for some of my more positive spin, you know, looking into my daughter's eyes, like, means that I can't completely go of any interpretation of a Gnostic text or the Apophicon of John that says, you know, this is a completely evil mistake, right? This world, and that, or a completely negative reading of existence. And again, right, like, you know, someday I will age and die, someday she will age or die, maybe she'll be hit by a car next year and die, right? But the dialectical relationship of what I was talking about, that the fact that I got to look into her eyes and have this wonderful experience, and she, I mean, I'm only talking about me, she's having a pretty great time, she's a pretty happy baby. So you know, I think right now, you know, she's asleep, but she had a baby mum before bed. I think she's pretty happy that Sophia made a mistake and that she got incarnated here, you know.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
And I think, like, you said earlier that it's like a Hallmark thing. I wonder too if we have a as Gnostics, particularly as Gnostics that are surrounded by theory and text, if we feel almost uncomfortable with simplicity, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, oh no, this is far too simple for me to just purely be feeling love in my daughter's eyes, you know, and translating that as an engagement of belief.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think this is some of this consciousness expanding stuff that I was talking about, where you know, maybe it sounds elitist. I'm sure there's other ways to do it, but doing all the Zen Koan stuff, reading all these complicated texts, having all these complicated ideas, that paradoxically expands your brain so that you can see and appreciate how simple things can and are be, you know. Mm-hmm. Because, again, to go Gnostically or to go, the human experience seems to be that we're constantly lost in illusion and delusion, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes just being able to see something that is very simple clearly is a great act, a wonderful act, mm-hmm. and a very hard act. And I think that's also that's part of the knowing of what Gnosticism calls for, right? Is gazing into a beloved's eyes. It can be as simple as that, but it's not, it's rarely, you know, like it is as simple as that, but it's not, you know?
Yeah.
We're all wrapped up in all these layers of illusion and delusion, right? Both exterior and interior. I think as well, you know, for my closing remarks, you know, when you read the Apophicon of John, you know, they say some things about the body, even then, that I don't really think, when they're talking about the body, they're talking about something that is, they're talking about the passions, they're talking about materiality, they're talking about the body, things are happening on a few different levels there, right? So it's not just your meat sack. But what the Apophicon of John is really obsessed with is the counterfeit spirit. Right. Which is what's that thing inside of your head. So I think too with Gnosticism, we spend too much time thinking about out there. This mean old world that's out to get me. And when you actually read the text, it's obsessed with, you know, what's in here, right? The counterfeit spirit is what it's really going on and on about. So I think that turn inward, I think too, the you know, that's an important aspect of the Gnostic contemplative turn inward. Anyways, okay.
Well, that's great. I think that's a tough act to follow. I think that's a great closing statement. The only addendum I want to put on there is that some of what you were talking about there about like the big ideas and stuff is that it reminds me of something I think Scott Rasbach said in one of the Conclave lectures he gave quite a few years ago, but I think it was the effect of that that some of these rituals and theories and ideas might be so complicated, specifically so that they break open your head so that you can have a simple thought, you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You can have a Gnostic experience, you know?
Well, we talked about in one of our many chats, right? Sometimes I think the mass is that, you know, where if you can make a simple meal of bread and wine, which is what people in the ancient world literally ate every day, and even now it's a pretty simple meal. If you can make that holy, then you can make anything holy. It's a trick, right?
Yeah.
A little trick on your brain.
What's that line from the AJC Mass? There is nothing mundane in the holy.
If I try to say it, I'll mess it up. And, you know, so let's put that in the show notes.
We'll put that in the show notes. Exactly.
Actually, the first Mass I ever went to had that. Oh, wait, what was it? They had a... sorry, this would be a funny story, folks, but there's another line that's something like... material, immaterial, like spiritual things are to be cherished, people are to be cherished, and material things are what we usually cherish. Do you remember what that line is?
When material things are used and people cherished, like something like disconnection happens when material things are cherished and people are used.
Yes, thank you. It's a beautiful line. Material.
Beautiful line.
But my first ever Mass, they actually had a misprint in the text that they handed out to people that said, you can guess what it said. It said the opposite. So that is
awesome.
Mass, yeah. Okay. Well, we should go.
I found the quote from one of the AJC documents here. Because I'm part of a local group. And so I've got these printouts. In the darkness of our ignorance, we sorrowfully proclaim there's nothing holy in the mundane. Yet by the light of the sacred flame, we see that there's nothing mundane in the holy. Which I just love that line. I mean, like, I'm not all about churchy stuff, and yet I find that line incredibly powerful. Yeah, I hope I didn't breach some kind of copyright to have stated that online.
I'm pretty sure you're allowed to say that one line. So if not, you'll hear about it. But no, you're allowed to quote. they don't print out the full masses. No. So, but I'm sure you're allowed to quote from it. Yeah. So. Okay. Good night.
Well, yeah, this has been great, John. Thank you so much for this. We'll hopefully they'll all hear you again asking me these questions sometime soon, and we'll go from there. Thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you again soon.